When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the California Angels and the City of Los Angeles, on the occasion of Her Majesty's royal visit, please welcome internationally renowned opera star Enrico Palazzo.
Yes, he's in the intensive care ward at Our Lady of the Worthless Miracle.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to a special Palazzo podcast episode put together here by our man, Chad. We are going to be chatting with MLB Pipelines, Sam Dykstra today. First, want to kind of encourage you guys to, if you're watching this on the YouTube, click subscribe, like, all that good stuff. We're still on our way towards 1,000 subscribers, and we're looking forward to getting that all done. You can also check us out on our Discord and all the socials, all that good stuff, Palazzo Podcast. I am very excited to have Sam Dykstra on with us today. Sam, welcome to the Palazzo Podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys.
So,
very lucky to get you this time of year. It's the busiest time of year for anyone doing prospects and draft, and just very grateful to have you.
Yeah, of course. No, thanks. Thanks again for reaching out.
So, Sam, for those who follow prospects and minor league baseball through the MLB.com and through MajorLeagueBaseball.com, your name is probably fairly familiar. You've kind of been working with that for quite a while. What can you give us a little bit of a background as to what got you first into minor league baseball and eventually working with MILB at the time and now with the Pipeline crew?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you say my first experience with minor league baseball, I like flashback to the 1990s with like the Pawtucket Red Sox, yeah. You know, going to games down at McCoy Stadium and having my birthday parties there and always having this love for, you know, the next level of baseball and realizing these are guys going after their dreams. And I always wanted to work in sports somehow. I went to Boston University for journalism, wanted to become a sports writer, studied a lot of sports journalism there, worked at the student newspaper, the Daily Free Press, became sports editor, was lucky enough to get an internship at WEEI.com, which mm-hmm. is the website of the obvious sports radio talk show there, where they were sending me to Red Sox games. They really gave me a lot of responsibility, and that was really eye-opening into getting into clubhouses and seeing what baseball journalism is like. And then, you know, I graduated a semester early in January 2012 and was applying everywhere across the country. I mean, getting a job in journalism is never easy, but it's especially felt that way a decade ago when everybody was transitioning from print to online first. And MILB.com reached out, and it seemed like a good fit. You know, I sent them a lot of my EEI stuff, including a clip in which I talked to Mariano Rivera, which, you know, as a 21-year-old, that's a good way to make yourself stand out. And they were like, do you want to move to New York and write about minor league baseball every night? So couldn't have said yes faster. I still remember getting the call on my ride home from New York to Massachusetts and having to pull over and frantically call my parents. But I started this job March 2012. One of my first interviews, to put that in a specific time, was Mike Trout
at AAA Salt Lake. I was just going to say that.
The debate at that time was who's the number one prospect in baseball, Mike Trout, Bryce Harper, or Matt Moore.
Yep.
I think, you know, we may still have that Trout versus Harper debate for a long time, but Moore has fallen off by the wayside. But yeah, I mean, through that, I was covering minor league games every night and transitioned to Dayside, where I started the minor league baseball podcast. Jake Seiner and Tyler Mon were original hosts, and me and Benjamin Hill have kind of done more with it as the years have gone by. We've done that show for about 8 years now.
Yeah.
And then about 3 years ago, I transitioned over to the MLB pipeline side, and I've always been writing about prospects, but now writing about them from an analytical point of view and putting tools to these guys and not just thinking about them as day-to-day players, but more on the macro sense, has been eye-opening, and it's been a lot of fun too.
And you're working with two of kind of the long-term legends in prospecting in Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. How has that been for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's been great. They've really welcomed me with open arms. And I think we really work well as a dynamic because we're all bringing something different to the table. Jim has worked in prospecting for decades now, going back to Baseball America and getting them really, like, they've been, obviously Baseball America set the standard in the 80s, but like he fleshed them out a little bit more. And then Jonathan Mayo helped MLB Pipeline get to be what it is from the first place. He was the guy who really took that to MLB.com, that side of prospecting. And then I'm showing up, you know, in my 12 years of covering minor league baseball now, I've grown with exit velocity and launch angle. Not that those guys aren't looking at that either, but I'm looking at it from an analytical point of view, and they're bringing in a different style. It works really well as a triangle dynamic.
Yeah,
absolutely. So why don't we jump right in? Actually, since you talk so much about growing up with the Red Sox and that, the biggest prospect news of the day: Nick York got promoted to AAA.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an interesting one to have happen today. I mean, as you guys know, like, there are Monday days off in the minor league, so that's when you'll see a lot of movement, is guys getting promoted on a Monday or early Tuesday morning. That's when it's announced anyways. So for it to come down today was a little odd, but he's already in the Worcester lineup. Nick York, I mean, it's been a roller coaster of a ride for him as a prospect in that Red Sox system. A lot of people were very surprised when he was taken as high as he was in the draft. They thought he could be stuck at second base, and he kind of has been. But the Red Sox always preached that we think this guy's going to hit. He's going to hit, and we're not as worried about the defense. A few years ago, it looked like that he was coming back around, and things were looking good again. And then it kind of plummeted starting the second half last year, and it hasn't been great this year. But he's up to 150 games of double-A experience. I mean, part of this promotion, I think, is to get him out of Portland, get him into a new environment, and maybe that challenge awakens something else in him. And you know, getting to see AAA pitching will be a little bit more helpful instead of languishing in AA. We'll see how it goes. I mean, his stock is slipping again this year, but sometimes that's what guys respond to, is a new challenge.
And I'm definitely optimistic, not just because you look at the major league roster and they haven't been able to hold down that middle infield in 2 years, really. So the opportunity is there if he can hit a AAA to quickly move up to the MLB side of things. But he's also, this year, only had a K rate about 20%. You know, not doing a whole lot in the power department, not doing as much on the bases, but just enough where he could be, you know, a solid 8-9 hitter this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I mean, he could move up to Worcester. And one thing I'm going to caution about that is, you know, AAA, because of the ABS system the last 2 years and the fact that it's split, right? Half the week is the challenge and half is full ABS. Guys get called up and you see their strikeout rates go down and their walk rates go up. And you think, oh, well, they must have made some adjustment. I think that's just pitching in a new system in a very defined zone. It makes it a lot easier as a hitter when you know exactly what's a strike and what's a ball day in and day out. And some guys are better at challenging than others. I mean, that's just another aspect of that whole system. So if he does move up to Worcester and we're looking up in 2 weeks and the strikeout rate's down to 15% and people get excited, I would chalk that up more to AAA than I would any adjustments he's made. Not that I'm saying he can't do it, but I think it's going to be longer term for us to see that happen.
And he's leaving one of the better rosters in all of minor league baseball.
Yeah, I was just about to point that out. Yeah. Like, that's the story of the week, has been everyone talking about how amazing that AA roster is, especially with Kyle Teal hitting all of a sudden. And now he works out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think those guys all liked, you know, pushing each other. And that's everything I've heard from the Red Sox going back to the spring was we like having that group together mm-hmm. because they do push each other. They challenge each other. They compete with each other in a healthy way. If one guy smokes 105 mile an hour double, the next guy wants to hit 106 mile an hour triple,
yeah.
like whatever they can do to one up each other. And I think that works really well among Marcelo Meyer and Roman Anthony and Kyle Teal, because all of those guys had some double A experience last year, but are getting their feet even more wet. Nick York's been there now for, not quite a year and a half, but basically a year and a half. I mean, it's kind of move time.
He's pretty much the old man there.
Yeah, he should be the one ahead of them, not still a little bit behind the rest of the group in terms of production.
And the other big prospect news of the week is a little bit more somber, and that's Cade Horn's injury. I believe it was officially declared a subscapularis strain. Mm-hmm. And man, it just breaks my heart because it's such a tricky, when you're talking the shoulder and the back and a pitcher, it just, talk me off the ledge here that everything's going to be okay with.
I mean, if I had to talk you off the ledge, it's that it's not necessarily an elbow, which I think it would be my number one concern for somebody who has a history of elbow problems. It's not great. I mean, him getting shut down for weeks, and then the word that I've seen is that it's going to take a while for him to build back up again. It's not just sitting for a few weeks and then coming back out and throwing 5-6 innings again. I mean, I'm not going to give up on him by any means. I'd rather have weeks than months. For a timeline on a return, and I'm sure the Cubs are just being super cautious here. I mean, he's a guy who was at Iowa already, and we'll see how the NL Central and the NL Wild Card is going to go. But, like, if they could get to a point where he's sitting now, builds back up, is at full bore by, let's say, you know, mid-late July, we could see Cade Horton in Wrigley Field in August and September pitching really meaningful innings for that team. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you do think they would still elevate him and not slow play him down the stretch if he's back and performing?
If he's back and performing, sure. I mean, all these weeks off means he's not meeting his innings.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he's not pitching innings right now. I mean, it's not ideal. You would rather have – if you're the Cubs, you would rather be making that decision on your own and not have an injury be making that decision for you. But I think if – given all this time off that he's had and the kind of the slow roll that he's had, if he's available in August, September, use him, mm-hmm. especially if they are in the thick of it in the wild card race, or if they're going at it with the Brewers in the NL Central.
Yeah. Hopefully it works out the rest of this year because baseball is more fun with Cade Horton. I talked to a couple players last year after the playoff series they pitched in. And literally got told, we looked who was pitching that day. Oh, Cade's pitching? Oh, okay, the series is over. Like, they're completely resigned to the fact that he was so dominant that they had no hope of winning.
Yeah, and I mean, he has a history of this too, right? Like, going back to the playoff run right before the draft. I mean, that's why the Cubs took him where they did, because they saw enough out of him very late. He's a guy who has a history of stepping up, and he's not going to shrink from big moments, even if he hasn't been pitching like he had in that spring.
So we got our first question on our YouTube channel here for you, Sam, from Jamie, who's asking, how challenging is it to cover the minor leagues? There's so many teams, learning players. How do you not get overwhelmed?
Yeah, I'll say this. It's a lot easier now than when he started. Yeah.
Well, that is true.
There's a lot less teams now.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it's, you know, you're trying to, your best to stay on top of it. I will say in MLB Pipeline, we divide up the 30 farm systems. Mm-hmm. So I am in charge of 10 farm systems, and I get a lot of help from beat writers as well. We have some beat writers who do the top 30s in the preseason. We have four of those, Adam Berry, Keegan Matheson, Annie Rogers, and Jason Beck. So shout out to them for helping on the preseason top 30s. But I do contribute to the top 100, so I'm keeping track on the biggest names everywhere. How do you not get overwhelmed? I mean, it's not easy, and I'm not going to say I don't get overwhelmed, especially come post-draft time and trade deadline time and re-rank time, and it gets a little insane. But at the end of the day, what I'm doing is watching baseball highlights and talking to baseball people and going to ballparks mm-hmm. across the country. I mean, that every once in a while I need to, like, a friend to text me that as a reminder, but like, it's still a lot of fun to do this stuff. And one of the most gratifying things is seeing those guys become stars and knowing that's why you're putting in the work. So people know what it's like. I remember one of the games I went to at Fenway Park was Clay Buchholz's major league debut. Now that would have been nothing to me if I didn't read up on prospect coverage at the time and know that this guy could be a dude. Then he threw a no hitter in his second start. So I missed him by one start, but still I can say I was there for his MLB debut. And I think about those fans who are going to games thinking like, oh, this is Jackson Churio's debut. This is Paul Skeen's debut. Who can I read and where can I find good information on that guy? And knowing I can be that resource, that kind of helps you get over that overwhelming feeling.
Yeah. And I guess for me, one of the fun things, you know, you talk about having to remind yourself what you're covering. I love on the Show Before the Show podcast, when we get into interviews with folks that do the brand identities or the, you know, the new promotions, the, you know, all those different things. You know, my wife was listening in the car with me one time when Benjamin Hill was on talking about the food that he was looking forward to eating that particular year, or well, highlighting. He doesn't necessarily do all the eating anymore. He's got his designated eaters, but she said, man, that's a job. She's like, that would be a great job. And she's not even a hardcore baseball person, but she's like, man, I would do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about the minor leagues, right? And that's one of the things I appreciate about our podcast is that we are covering it completely, like business matters, you know, team names, team logos, team alternate identities, prospects on the field. Like, we know when you go to a minor league ballpark, you're not just there to check in on the Cubs number 11 prospect. You are there because they happen to be wearing a Copa identity that day, or, you know, it's dollar beer night at the ballpark. Like, there's so many things that are important in minor league baseball, and we want to make sure they're all covered. And that's, and again, you're talking about like triangles between me, Jonathan, and Jim. I think between me, Tyler, and Ben, Tyler, who's worked in this industry, Ben, who's covered it for a long time, we do that really well as well.
I mean, and then of course you have Josh Jackson thrown in as, you know, his old school. I think I've sent him like three or four South Dakota ones that he could really dig into and have fun with. I think he used one. He sent me an email and said thank you on one of them that he did use. But because we got some great stories out here of ball players and things that have gone on. So,
all right, you guys want to jump right into the action from the weekend?
Sure.
Sounds good.
Ben, you want to take us away? Because I believe you watched a lot more than I did.
Well, yeah, and I guess I was getting ready to prepare a MLB draft article myself, watching the college regionals, and thought, well, crap, all the guys I want to write about no longer are going to be playing going forward. You know, you can't talk about a Chase Burns. You can't talk about, some of the – frankly, anybody left on the LSU team from last year that's still there. But I guess one of the things that caught my attention, Sam, we didn't know for sure if Treya Savage was even going to be able to pitch. And he comes out and kind of, for at least momentarily, saved ECU's season. Now, they didn't, you know, he went head-to-head with Chase Burns. It's kind of the matchup we were all hoping to see. Chase didn't fare as well. But then they got knocked off by Evansville, which I always enjoy, you know, the Oral Roberts, the Evansville, the team like that, that comes up and makes at least to super regionals, sometimes to Omaha. But what do you think a performance like that for a guy like Savage can do for his draft stock?
Yeah. I mean, it can only help. I mean, establishing health was, like you said, a big deal. Throwing seven and a third innings like he did was big. I mean, that was no weak Wake Forest team. I know they didn't make it through, and that was maybe my biggest disappointment as a draft follower. I wanted to see what would happen with Burns and Kurtz moving forward. And now we don't get any more of them until the draft, which is disappointing. But for him to move through that lineup, I think it's only going to help him. I think it also might, I don't want to say like losing for East Carolina is a bad thing, but the fact that that's his last start might not be a terrible thing because now we don't see him get hurt on the mound.
Yeah, I was just
like, the more opportunities to pitch or more opportunities to get hurt. I still have some questions about the control. 4 walks and 7 1/3 isn't great. And he had 6 strikeouts over 7 1/3, which is fine, but it's not spectacular. But I think him getting that in when there were so many health questions was well timed for Tre'Davious Savage. And now he just kind of has to wait and see where he goes in the draft. It seems like maybe the mid teens, but who knows?
And quite frankly, if you want to consider he and Burns and Hagen Smith as your top three, he's the guy who had the weekend out of those three.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if he's wanting to sneak into that, well, not even necessarily sneak into the top 10, but establish himself as a top 10 player, that was a heck of a start to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as for you, Sam, who was the team that kind of surprised? I mean, obviously Evansville is the easy one, but beyond Evansville, who's the team that really surprised you getting into the Super Regionals?
I mean, this might be a little bit of my homerism, and I understand that I didn't go to the University of Connecticut, but like I do get a kick out of New England teams doing well. UConn coming out of that group, and not just the fact that they came out of the group, but the way or the roster that they did it in. They don't have anybody in our draft 200 right
now.
Yeah. Like there's not a great draft prospect on that team, but they did really well in the transfer portal, particularly getting guys from Division III who usually get overlooked, especially in cold weather states like that. And I think their winning pitcher from the game, from that final game against Oklahoma, came from Endicott. Like you talk about taking advantage of the moment and getting guys who you think can perform for you. I mean, they did a really, really good job of getting that roster together, doing well in the Big East, punching their ticket, and now continuing that momentum. I'm not saying they're going to go far, but like at the end of the day, if your goal is to win in NCAA, they've built the roster to do that. And the fact that they did it over the weekend was pretty
good. Yeah. I guess for me, I was really surprised by Kansas State. I did not expect them.
Kansas State was my second one. Yeah.
They do have kind of one guy who's maybe a guy, but there's a lot of questions on their only real high end draft pick. Or draft prospect. But that's a team that all season long, it just seemed like whenever I'd turn on and happen to watch a game, they were a team that didn't quit with 2 outs in the 9th inning. And so, I wasn't surprised that they were in it. It just surprised me that they actually pulled off and won it in the end. So,
yeah. Well, especially going up against Arkansas.
Yeah.
On the road like they did in Fayetteville. I mean, Kalen Culpepper, who is, I assume, who you were referencing.
Yes, there, yes, sorry.
Their draft prospect. But, you know, he started the regionals by hitting for the cycle and follows that up by homering off Hagen Smith in game 2 at Arkansas. And I was watching a video before of him talking about that. And he was like, it's one of the craziest environments I've ever played in. And to connect like he did going opposite field, I mean, the big question we have on him going into the draft, right, is how is his power going to play? It's a 45 grade pool on our site right now. To take the best left-hander in this draft deep in a big spot like that on the road, I'm not saying it's going to erase all the questions, but it certainly helps answers.
Yes, absolutely. You know, for you watching this year, is probably your best draft team that's left is Florida State. As far as prospects, high-end prospects, Tennessee probably has more depth. But Florida State with Tibbs and Cam Smith up top. And I mean, granted, every team that's left has somebody, it seems like, well, maybe except UConn and Evansville, but, you know, has somebody that you're thinking about for the draft. But for me, the team that I'm so glad made it through is West Virginia, because we get to see a little more J.J. Weatherholt.
Yeah, that's huge. And one thing, you know, I was writing down some notes before we started here, and, you know, I was talking to Jim Callis about this on the Pipeline podcast this week, and he was saying one thing that stood out to some folks is, like, if you only watch J.J. Weatherholt play defense over the weekend, you'd be like, that guy's a sure thing
shortstop.
And that's maybe one of the biggest questions we have on Weatherholt is like, is he a shortstop or is he a second baseman? Because if you see him as a shortstop, you'd probably draft him five spots higher than you do if you see him as a second baseman. He showed good range. He showed a strong arm against Grand Canyon. He had a throw from the hole that hit the first baseman on a line. I don't know if he can do that consistently, but again, it's not only about hitting at that level. Like if you have a spotlight on you, if you can grab it in any way you can, that's huge. Now we'll get more looks at JJ Weatherholt. Maybe he flubs a ball or doesn't show as good range another time, but like he's taking the opportunity and running with it on the defensive side.
Well, and he's a guy that I don't know how serious any discussion is on him at number one overall, but he certainly isn't out of the idea for number one overall. He'd definitely be a dark horse behind Bezzana and Condon, but you can really say for sure you've got your two top draft picks still playing. Almost certainly the top two guys on most draft boards, and a guy like Weatherholt still playing gives him a chance to potentially work his way into that level. I mean, he was that level before the season started. It's really been injuries that kind of dropped him down, because once he's been healthy, he's been excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's going to be huge, is what can he do with these extra at bats that he's getting to kind of elbow his way in? Because who knows? I mean, that's the thing about this draft class, right? Like I agree with you that there are top two guys with a bullet, and it seems like, you know, whoever Cleveland doesn't take, Cincinnati will probably pick up at number two, whether it's Condon or Bezzana. But you never know. Like Cleveland could try to cut a deal with somebody. And if JJ Weatherholt's that guy, cutting a deal with somebody who has a plus-plus hit tool and is going to play up the middle either way, that's fine. Oh, yeah. I mean, that would actually kind of fit Cleveland's.
I was just going to say, like, if there's a guy that fits, that would definitely be a guy that fits. No.
I would prefer them going and getting a power bat just being like, hey, this is a real big hole we have in our system. Let's not just go and repeat the process with what we've done. But sometimes you work with what works in your system. And if you know how you can develop those guys with hit tools like a Weatherholt, go back to the well again.
So who are you looking forward? I mean, you know, we just mentioned Weatherholt. Who are you looking forward to getting some more looks at because their team happened to advance?
Yeah. I mean, Jack Caglione, I'm continually fascinated by him.
So I actually had a question I wanted to bring up regarding him, because we were talking about who was third behind those two.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think that was one of the few people I got to watch this weekend, was him destroying baseball after baseball.
Right.
The pure talent level, like, you know, 2-3 years ago, he was the clear number one for a while. Obviously, the pitching side really hasn't panned out. How much is the first base bias, knowing that we've only had 4.75 first basemen in the top five in the last 26 years, hurting his draft stock?
I don't think it's only that. I think part of the reason why he was number one so long ago is like because of the two-way status, and everybody wants him. It's kind of like Nolan McLean right now in the Mets system. Everybody wants him to be the next Otani, and then you look at one side for McLean, it's his hitting side, and realizing he's striking out 40-50% of the time. Caglione, you look at the pitching side, you're like, there's some interesting things here, but then he gives up four homers in a start over the weekend, and like that's tough to swallow. And I think that's gonna be easier for a drafting team to point to him and be like, hey, listen, you could be like a single A, high A starter right now, but we think you're a double A bat. Which one, how do you want to get to the big leagues? Because we can get you to the big leagues very quickly as a hitter. Now, like, if he is hitter only first base, I think it drags him back a little bit. The other thing I find fascinating with him, and it's tough balancing this, he chases a lot, but doesn't swing and miss a lot.
Yep.
He's got a little bit of – it's Vladdy Guerrero syndrome, right? Like, if you can have that hand-eye coordination – Jack Wilson is the same way, but Jack Wilson doesn't have Jacob Wilson, doesn't have the power that Caglione does. He's swinging at everything because he knows he can drive everything. But what happens when all of a sudden you're going up against a double-A arm who's going to be throwing at the letters and you actually can't touch that? Or they just stay below the knees the whole time. You're rolling it over to second base. Even if it's at 96 miles an hour, it's still a 4-3 ground out. He's going to have to make those adjustments. I think that's what has him the layer below those guys. But yeah, there's a lot to get excited about with him. I don't think first base is holding him back too much.
And I got to wonder, if within this draft, having a guy like Nick Kurtz hit the way that he has as a first base primary guy maybe pushes him a little bit as far as, you know, not saying that Torque was a bad college bat by any means, but having other guys in that draft who were also a first baseman and could, you know, were putting up big numbers, that could have certainly pushed him and maybe changed some decisions or at least challenged some decisions. Because if you're saying Caglione's the best first base bat out there, well, you know, that's kind of insulting Nick Kurtz a little bit because he's had a pretty darned amazing year.
Yeah. I just think like nobody makes as much hard contact as Caglione does. And I think that's what you need to do at first base. And he fits the bill. Kurtz has had a good season by all means. I mean, we have him right now at number four on our list, which ahead of the two big arms, which there's a lot to get excited about there. But, you know, when you have a truly elite tool like Jack does, I think that pushes you up into the upper reaches of these rankings.
And
I think the other player who maybe rose his draft stock the most of anyone all weekend was Christian Moore.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just curious, with the Weatherholt situation, does that impact how high he can get? Whether Weatherholt's second base or shortstop?
Does that affect Moore, you mean?
Yes, because Moore's going to be a pure second baseman most likely.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they really matter to each other too much. I mean, I think teams looking at Christian Moore aren't going to be having the opportunity to look at Weatherholt. I mean, we got Moore right now at our 25. So he's looking at like a late first round situation. I mean, there's a possibility that Weatherholt could continue to drop and then somebody with a large bonus pool scoops him up in the late 20s or something like that. I don't foresee that coming. I think they're just two independent players. Christian Moore continuing to play on a good Tennessee team is certainly going to help him. He, like you said, he had a good weekend, 4-for-13, double, homer, 4 walks, 4 strikeouts. Like the pieces are there for him to do fine. I just don't think Weatherholt's going to – like if a team sees Weatherholt as a second baseman, they're going to see him as a better hitting second baseman than Moore is anyway.
And I guess –
and that's why I asked, if that happens, would that – and Weatherholt does fall back to maybe 8 or 9 or 10. Because I know Jim Callis had talked about Moore potentially getting as high as 12 to the Red Sox.
Yeah.
If Weatherholt slides into a spot where a second baseman can go and there's not another good fit, could we see Moore slip further back despite the performance?
No, I don't think it's necessarily that. I mean, once you're in that 12 range anyways, you're picking the best player on the board, or you should be. I don't think you're looking at it of like, for the Red Sox, we have an opening at second base. Who are our two second base options? You're looking at it as who do we just overall think is a better prospect? That could be an outfielder. That could be a pitcher. Like the other guys could be dropping as well. I don't think they're necessarily competing against each other purely as second baseman. It's just who are you as a draft prospect?
So we got another question from Jamie. As a journalist, how do you view the MLB draft? Do you prefer one position over another? Or does it come down to prospects more than position in general?
Yeah, I mean, the draft calculus is one that everybody is trying to figure out at all times.
Especially the Royals.
The guys good in the guys in draft rooms are trying to figure this out in a way. Like if this had been perfected, then everybody would be on auto draft, right? Like we wouldn't have teams debating like they do in draft rooms. Me personally, position does affect things in general. I like a guy who is going to be up the middle, whether that's shortstop, center field, catcher. Like if you can do one of those three things, you're automatically going to be higher in my book. So long as you can do them
that
well.
That kind of makes this like a tough draft, though. Catcher.
This is a tough draft in that way, yeah, because then, like we were saying before, that catcher – standout catcher doesn't really exist in this draft. There's
not both sides. Yeah. I mean, you have some guys that are solid hitters or solid backstops, and there's a good college catching group, but they kind of feel like about pick 15 is where you're going to start seeing catchers come off the board for out of that top group. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right. Like, there's not like a Kyle Teal or a Blake Mitchell
that you're going to be surprised if they drop down to 15, you know, that.
Right.
But yeah. And certainly, Vance Honeycutt's probably your best true center fielder. out of the.
And he's so, such a frustrating evaluation in his own.
Yeah.
Look at his
weekend either.
Yeah.
I think he hit two home runs and then was like 0 for his next 8 or something like that.
Yeah. He, Jim and Jonathan lead our draft coverage, but what I've constantly kept an eye on Honeycutt because I'm like, what do you do with him?
Mm-hmm.
Like, where do you put him? Because the tools are obviously there, but if he ends up being somebody, like you were saying, struck out 8 times in 17 at bats. That's really difficult to keep on a roster.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Joey Gallo levels in college, and it's only going to get worse from there. I'm not saying he's Joey Gallo, but like, it's just a tough evaluation. So for me, I do think I look at loud tools. I look at where you are on the diamond, and then, you know, kind of fill it out from there. That's how I think most draft boards go. If you have loud tools like Caglione, then you're going to go high on the draft. If you have a really good set of breaking pitches like Chase Burns and you can touch triple digits, you're going to go high too, even if you're a right-handed. There are ways of elbowing past guys in that, but I do keep position in mind.
Hey, keep your eyes on the road. This is the Blotto Podcast. We'll be right back after these pointless messages.
So I guess one question I would have on this year's drafts, and not necessarily to do now with so much with College World Series playoffs, but there were some really talented arms coming into the season. You know, thinking of guys like Ben Brecht being one of them, or Brody mm-hmm. Brecht, sorry. And, right. You know, you've got Jonathan Santucci. You know, there's some really talented guys that didn't have the year that you expect, or fell off due to injury. How, and they're kind of going up. I don't know that there's a high school arm along the lines of like a Jackson Job that's going to jump in against Smith and Burns and Savage, but how tough is it going to be for those guys who had a rough draft year in college on the mound with the depth of college or high school pitching that's about at the same spot where they're probably going to be considered in the draft this year?
Yeah, I mean, that comes down to a point where, you know, we're talking about like the late 20s or mm-hmm. something like that. If I'm a team like the Dodgers or the Rays, these teams that have really good pitch design pipelines, and like Brody Brecht is sitting there, I consider taking him, even if, you know, the rest of the industry is a little bit more down on him or he didn't have a good year. We're kind of seeing that now. This isn't a perfect example, but like George Klassen,
yeah,
Minnesota pitcher
in the Philadelphia. I'm a gopher myself, so I was a huge fan of him.
There you go. Praising, preaching to the choir here, but Klassen's had a great start for the Phillies system. And a lot of people are like, I don't think he can throw strikes. The stuff is wicked, but I don't think he can. And then he's doing that because he got pro style pitching guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like Quinn Matthews going the other way. Stanford standout last year, everybody was talking about, was 156 pitches.
Yeah. Through.
That's what he was known for, but wasn't known for velo. Now he's in the mid 90s in the Cardinals system. Like, it doesn't have to just be teaching command. It can be teaching stuff too.
Yeah.
So if you're an organization that can harness good stuff or good command, the Guardians used to be in that mode too, though I don't think they're going to take an arm up top. I would still take the talented college arms, even if they've had a rough season. Like, you, if you can see the mold of the ball of clay, and you think you can mold it, take it.
Well,
in one of those
spots. A guy like Brecht is such an athlete that, you know, there's teachable there. You know, I mean, you right. know, former college football player as well. I mean, which, you know, saying you're a wide receiver for Iowa is about saying, you know, you're you're playing offensive line in the Arena Football League. It's a little bit different than, you know, a different league. But at the same time, it takes a heck of a lot of athleticism to get there. And, you know, and to be able to legit play two sports at a Big Ten college, that's impressive just straight out, let alone excelling at both. I think he was the leading receiver for Iowa one year with like 10 catches. So, you know, that just kind of says what, but that's just who they are. That's not on him. But that is the other end of things to me, looking at this draft. I don't know that there's an elite high school arm that really deserves to be considered top 10, but man, there's going to be a lot of depth from about pick 20 to round through round three, where you probably should see a lot of teams that have some available money snatching up a lot of high school arms, you would think.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably where the run is going to start, right? Is like just outside the top 10. I'm fascinated, you know, Jonathan Mayo did an executive survey for our site as part of the top 200 update. And one of the questions was, who do you think is the top prep arm in this class? And the answer was Cam Caminiti, who's left-handed. He's still young. He's only 17. He's not turning 18 until August. So he's projectable in that way, 6'2". Left-handed certainly helps. Got a good slider and a changeup. I really like William Schmidt. You know, the fact that he's got maybe the best curveball in this draft is certainly something. You want to talk about, like, who could be that Jackson Jobe equivalent? Jackson Jobe, everybody knew he had an elite slider coming into the draft, and it's like, how can we harness everything else? Schmidt has that right now. He's older than Caminiti is. He'll be turning 19 in October. Maybe some teams are going to shirk at that a little bit. And he is right-handed. Maybe that affects it. But get his fastball and curveball in there, and I'd be fascinated to see what a team can do. And again, he's 6'4", 180. He's going to add muscle, I think, as he goes along.
Yeah, and see, I'm such a huge, huge fan of Cash Mayfield, so I'm kind of curious as to where he might end up in the back end of the first, early second, right in that area, is what it looks like. But you never know. Maybe the guy comes out and says, I want $5 million to sign, and then that kind of just means he's going to college. So you just don't know that until you get closer to the draft, and all of a sudden he's sliding into day three. You're like, oh, there might be some money things going on here. But
yeah, I mean, we could always have a Matt Allen situation too.
Yep.
Not that that's worked out great for the Mets, but like everybody saw Matt Allen sliding and they're like, well, he's going to school. That's that. And then all of a sudden the Mets pop him. What was it? The third round that they got him because they started doing savings and drafting senior signs and whatever they could do to scrape together enough money to get Matt Allen. It seemed like a great pick. Now, there's a lesson in that too, right? If you're putting so many eggs into a high school pitching bucket, that's some things could follow from there. You never know how health is going to go as they get into their 20s, but it is possible. Like if a guy starts dropping, don't assume he's automatically going
to college. And I know
the one that's so fascinating to me, and we, with our previous draft interview, we talked about him a little bit, was David Shields, just because he had such a awkward situation because of the mono.
Yep.
And that his talent might be a lot higher than his draft stock.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, another guy who's left-handed, 6'2", young at 17. He won't be 18 until September. He's got a decent slider. We'll see how it comes together. I like the control. Yeah, maybe we'll be looking a few years down the line and he's added velocity too. But the more question marks you have on high school arms, like the tougher it is to swallow to take them, right? Yeah.
I just get this nagging thing in the back of my head that the talent's too good to take where he's going to get drafted and he's going to want to go to school.
It's possible. But the other thing I'll say to that is like anybody who gets taken in the top 10 rounds at this point usually signs. I mean, it's because teams are in discussions with agents ahead of time. Just been like, hey, if we take you here, what is it going to be to sign you? Because we're not going to take you if this is going to be a whole negotiation.
And
so if he does get taken, then yes, I think he'll sign.
So one of the rare guys who didn't sign lately in the top 10 rounds kind of fits a – you talked about the Mets, and Brandon Sproat is one who did not sign a couple years back in the third round, then signed after being drafted in the second. But he's a the Mets have a type. It's Florida pitchers, and they seem to develop them well. Who's the Florida guy they're going to turn into a mid-rotation starter in this year's draft?
That's a great question. I haven't actually looked at it through that lens yet. I'm gonna do that once we hang up here, because I was thinking of that the other day. Brandon Sproat, we have him ranked outside the top 10 for the Mets right now, but he's been touching triple digits since the spring. I thought part of that was he was just warmed up because he was used to playing in college, but it's stuff that's holding in a way that was really exciting about Christian Scott last year. We're getting that with Sproat now. And yeah, I mean, it's he's performing really well at Double A. Sliders look great. Changeups looks great. He might even have a deeper arsenal than Scott does. He just has a tick or two less command. But the Mets have a type, and they, you know,
maybe they'll surprise us and go Florida closer and go Brandon Nealon.
Well, I mean, you know, like the Christian Scott was a reliever
yeah.
for the Gators. Like they've
done it before.
It worked out in that case too. Yeah.
No, and that's, to me, those are kind of the fun things when you watch the draft. You get certain teams that you know have a type. You know, you have certain that, yeah. You kind of figure whoever the Angels pick is going to probably be playing in the majors by May of next year, if not sooner. But, you know, watching, you come up just before the Royals and you just know that somebody's going, well, how are they going to screw up my mock? You know, because they've been notorious in the last few years for exactly that. But the team that I've got an eye on this year personally is the Arizona Diamondbacks. A couple years ago, they had like 7 picks in the top 2 rounds and really didn't get as much out of those players as you would have maybe thought, although they used a number of them in trades. And so, you know, that's, you know, figure out how you want to value that. But, they've got 3 in the top like 40 this year for picks. I think they're 4th or 5th in overall pool value, but they don't even pick until pick 29. So that kind of tells you just how much damage they could do, I guess, at the end of the first round. Do you think that there's a lot that, you know, a team like that, do they come in just kind of sitting back and waiting to see who falls and who they can throw money at, or do they have a guy or two that they might have designed something with?
I mean, that'll be fascinating, right? Like they could reach out to a player and be like, hey, listen, if you are there at 29, we're going to take you because we have 2 more picks in the top 35. Like, so just tell everybody else you're going to demand $9 million. And then when it comes to us, we'll sign you for 3.5 or whatever. But like they could sit back and wait for that to happen. Who knows who that player is going to be? I don't think they're going to reach out to a Jack Caglione and be like, hey, demand number 1 overall money and we'll take you at 29. I mean, it's probably somebody in that top 15 we're talking about there. Or they could just go for 3 solid players. I don't think there's anything wrong with that strategy either. Sometimes people talk about, well, you've got your pool, so you should be spending it on 67% of one guy and then 2 other guys who can be kind of depth pieces. I don't think there's anything wrong with like getting 3 solid players who, if they are in that top 35, should have the potential to be top 100 guys eventually and a top 100 overall for all of minor league baseball. Use that depth to your advantage too. Like if there are 3 guys you like there, go ahead and take them. Don't just try to push all your chips into one guy just so you can have a sparkly new thing and then 2 guys who are much less likely to work out.
The team I'm most fascinated by is the Marlins this year because they do have a type. It's extremely young, raw, high potential pitchers. There aren't a ton of those in this class. They also vastly underperformed this year and are blowing up the major league roster. It seems like for the first time forever, they could go in any direction here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? Like they have a new baseball ops department, essentially. Peter Bendix is going to probably make a different call than Kim Ang did in that draft room. Not that I'm saying he's necessarily driving the conversation, and nor is Kim Ang like the reason why they took Meyer and White last year. But there is a different decision maker at the top. So I think they are a little bit more of a wild card in terms of who are they going to take. But like you said, them drafting at 16, guys like Schmidt and Caminiti could very well be in part of that conversation right around. Like it might be the case where if Schmidt is number 1 on their board, yeah, it looks like they're drafting the type, but like take him anyways. Don't go away from the best player on your board just because you're worried about fan perception of like, oh, here we go again with another high school arm. Who knows? You might have a rotation one day led by Meyer, White, and Schmidt. And that's things that teams drool over.
Yeah. And Meyer has really picked things up after a rough start to the year. White has been pretty consistent all year. So yeah, you add another arm into that to have kind of grow together through the minor leagues. That'd be a really fun thing, high school wise. Bring in another prep arm. Never mind that they already have some pretty darn elite arms at the top end of their farm system as it is. Of course, they need to be healthy. Guys like Max Meyer, guys like, you know, of course, they need to get Sandy Alcantara back. But yeah, there's some really fun arms in that Miami system. But the Braves have shown you can make a farm system out of just arms somehow. I don't know how that works for them, but they hit on their hitters, and then they just have such a load of arms that they can throw arms at whatever holes they have in the rotation, in the bullpen, things like that.
And then on top of that, they trade away all the misses somehow.
I mean, internal evaluation is a skill. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that development is a skill. And if you can develop prospects, that's great. If you live life like the Baltimore Orioles and every bat that comes through all of a sudden looks like a legit major league contributor, that's great. But also you have to know who to trade.
Yeah.
When you are making those calls, a team might call you and say, we want this guy or this guy. And you have to know which one of the two you would. And like that, kudos to the Braves organization for knowing the guys to not get rid of, but like to send away in those deals.
But I mean,
come out winners pretty consistently.
As someone who follows that Braves system pretty close, there have been guys who had some reputation when they walked out the door in trades and just haven't turned into anything with their new organization. They seem to have picked the right guys. And, you know, if the guys that they keep turn into something usable, you know, and that's just, it's really an impressive thing to watch with that club. Love them or hate them, they seem to know what they're doing there. But Sam, I want to be cognizant of your time here, but we do have someone who's asking a question specific on the Nats, on the Nationals at 10. They're kind of one of the unfortunate teams with the pick lottery. The Nationals are kind of the first team to really kind of get screwed over by that, if you want to put it that way. But at the same time, you're still getting the top 10 pick. You can't complain too awful bad. But
right.
But what do you think makes a lot of sense there? I mean, obviously it all depends on how it plays out in front.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that Mike Rizzo has long done, and he has a scouting background, so he's somebody who is very much a part of those conversations, although they've made some changes to their scouting development department. So we'll see how that kind of goes down in terms of who's leading the discussions in the room. But usually when it's a first round pick, it's somebody pretty high up, and Mike Rizzo likes to be involved there. What have the Nats done in the last few years? They love taking high upside swings. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dylan Cruz at number two last year, yes, that's a high upside swing, but it's still pretty safe. But like, you're taking a guy who was the Golden Spikes winner. And that seemed like, at least, you know, from what we've heard, a pretty easy decision on their part. But you look at like Elijah Green, who they took when they took him a few years back, and it was because he has tools for days. And now we're seeing the other side of that, right? He's kind of still striking out a ton. Everybody I talk to with the Nats is like, don't give up on Elijah. Don't give up on Elijah. We're in it for the long term. It is what it is. And that's fine. But I think when you're looking for the Nats, I don't think they're just going to take like the low ceiling, high floor type at number 10. You know, if I'm trying to think of like who could drop to them. If Chase Burns were to drop to them, like that's the perfect example, right? Like he has an immense ceiling with some questions about his fastball shape. But if he gets to the Nationals at 10, I don't think they blink twice and be like, we can mold everything else. We'll take it.
Yeah. Smith is the other one I was just thinking of there. Like a Hagen Smith would be another one. If he happened to somehow fall there, I think they would run to the podium.
Yeah. Like Nick Kurtz could be available to them. I don't think he necessarily fits that bill perfectly in terms of really, really loud tools. But like, I think they would be happy to take him if he were to fall. It seems like they're more the floor for somebody high.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to reach down into like the 20s of our ranking and pull somebody up. I think it's more likely.
And
somebody with question marks will land to the Nats and they'll be like, we're hopeful that we can figure everything else out.
I've seen a number of mocks now where that's the first high school pick come off the board, whether it's Griffin or someone, you know. And I've also seen the reach that I've seen is someone like Siever King, which does kind of make some sense. There's a high-end athlete that is maybe looking for a position, so maybe that's a guy that fits. But that's still – you're talking about a guy who's probably more of a – a 15 to 20 guy in most rankings or even lower. And I don't know, that seems like a little bit of a push to get him at 10.
Yeah. I mean, he would be kind of like, I don't want to say the anti Elijah Green, but his negative is in his power.
Yep.
And we're like, where do you play him defensively? But it's above average hit. It's good speed. It's good throwing arm. Yeah. I mean, that would be a fascinating one. Maybe they do reach down to get him. I do think, like, you're right about Connor Griffin. Mm-hmm. Like, they might be like, hey, we're the high guy on Connor Griffin. We love the way he runs. We love the way he hits for power. And we'll figure out the hit tool, kind of like we're trying to do with Elijah Green. It hasn't worked out yet, but again, there have been some changes in the Nats system where maybe you get Connor Griffin earlier, or like Elijah Green has had to deal with those the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Connor Griffin can plug himself into the new system and figure it out maybe quicker.
Yeah. So
then the last one I have on my radar is a player specifically, and it's another one I've talked about extensively, and that's Jacob Cozart. And we talked earlier about how the catcher is kind of underwhelming. There's not that true both sides of the game catcher. Cozart's starting to look like that. He keeps shining in these opportunities, including this past weekend. Could he sneak into the first round at this point?
I mean, he certainly could. It's not something I've necessarily heard a lot about in terms of like him being the number one catcher on in like if I had to set an over under on how many catchers are going to get drafted in the first round, I would say like 2.5, and I would lean more towards 2 than I would 3. Yeah. And you're probably talking about like a Loma Vita or more sneaking in. I mean, it's certainly possible. Like, the more baseball he's going to be playing, the more he can build up momentum, and the fact that we have him as a 55 grade tool, like fielding tool. And I think that still holds some value mm-hmm. for some organizations. And they think like, we'll build around everything else. There's some power there. I would just like to see a 60 on his scouting sheet. And that just doesn't exist for him right now for me. But you know, it only takes one club. I haven't heard anything yet, but who knows, maybe somebody very late sneaks him in there.
I'm a fantasy first prospect guy, so I see that skill set, and it's especially at that position feels like it's something. Like, he could be that perfect, solid but not great, like a Will Smith light.
Maybe I don't know. I would like to see a little bit more power before I'm going to say Will Smith light, but yeah, but it kind of that same way, though, right? Like, if he's just a solid regular, you can maybe get that in the second round. I don't think you're you want somebody in your first round who has the potential to be above average regular, and I don't think that's quite what Cozart is.
Yeah, because Sean Murphy was what, a third?
Something like that. Yeah.
Say it. Now, granted, you're coming from a smaller school, but then again, you know, you're not exactly talking a huge school when you're talking Walker Yannick either. So, I mean, that's just kind of the, you know, Sam Houston comparatively to your SECs, your, you know, schools, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I guess I will go back for one moment here to what's coming up this weekend, Sam. And I took the numbers, I went through and crunched because I was just curious. There are equal amounts of teams from the SEC and the ACC that will be playing starting this weekend, five of them for each, but they represent 10 of the 16 teams that advanced this to this next round. Are we heading to a rough thing with college baseball to where we're going to have kind of two or maybe three super conferences every year and be watching to hopefully find who can be the fun team out of the rest of them?
I don't know. I mean, that's a conversation about like all of NCAA athletics that I will be honest with you. I am not qualified to be like NIL. What is the deal with that? And like, I do think that's a big part of it now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Athletes are getting paid a lot earlier. If you are a bigger school and a bigger program and a bigger conference, you know, I'm sad to see the Pac-12 go.
Yeah.
I've spent all my life on the East Coast, but like, it was an awesome conference that existed out there, and it's kind of getting erased and being shipped for parts. So if we're headed that direction, I don't know. But then, like, in baseball, right, the way the system is set up, you can have a team like Evansville.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever want to lose
them,
either. And anything can happen in baseball. Any, you know, if you're doing these, they're not doing seven-game series for all these opponents. When you're only playing one game at a time, I love the upsets, and I think that's still a possibility. That's always going to be a possibility, specifically in baseball, no matter what. Even if the conferences end up being like three or four super conferences, they're still going to be like the eighth best team in one of those conferences that squeaks through in a way that nobody saw coming. And we'll be celebrating it in a different way, but we'll still be celebrating it because underdogs are fun.
Absolutely.
Definitely. And we almost saw that with the women's side of it. With A&M, and that was just fun to watch. You need to have that in baseball. Right.
Yeah. Well, Chad, do you got anything more for our guy Sam here? Because
I wanted to touch on the draft league briefly, but we've gone an hour and it's been great. So I'm good to wrap it up here if you guys are.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just throw out some draft league names quick.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because I put together a few of them real quick. Just for any of your listeners who haven't seen draft league rosters yet, there are going to be some names that you might recognize. One really fun one is Jaden Agassi, who's pitching for Mahoning Valley. Yeah. Didn't pitch this year in college, but went to USC. And if that name sounds familiar, it should, because he is the son of Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf. Two tennis stars, obviously, but he's trying to make his way in pitching. Tervell Johnson is Tamar Johnson's brother, playing for Frederick. He actually played for Frederick last year. He moved to Texas Rio Grande Valley, trying to see if he can kind of make it through. I think he had hopes of being drafted last year. Didn't work out, but is heading back to the draft league to prove himself. Another name people will recognize is Bryce Martin Grudzielanek, who's playing for Trenton. He's Mark's son. He also played at USC. And then there are two Ugandan players, not only one this year. Dennis Kasumba, who was the catcher who played in the draft league last year for Frederick, he's back for this year, but also they have a right-handed pitcher, Sempa Shawali Sherikon. And that's really fun. Both of those guys will be playing for the Frederick Keys. It's a sign of how baseball is expanding beyond just the traditional markets, not only the United States, but also the Dominican Republic, Cuba, Mexico, places like that. And, you know, there will probably be a lot of people from Uganda paying attention to how these guys do. So it'll be a lot of fun to keep an eye on Kasumba and Shawali Sherikon.
And, you know, for me, it's really cool. One of the guys that I noticed, because I always like to look at these rosters, look for guys from Minnesota, from South Dakota, which is where I live. And one of the guys that stuck out real quick, guy from Beijing, China, from Augustana University in South Dakota, Tom Sun. You know, just kind of like, oh, well, that's a guy that could be kind of interesting. Like, not a normal thing in South Dakota to have somebody from China end up at one of the colleges here, and then he ends up in the draft league. That's very fun to consider. That's one of the fun parts about the draft league overall.
Yeah. I mean, you look at, I think very much a draft league success story is Chen-Wei Lin, who's in the Cardinals system, signed for $500,000 as an international signee because he comes out of Taipei. He played for the Chinese Culture University in Taipei, and then he moved to the Northwoods League. But now he's very much legit a Cardinals prospect. He was always throwing hard, always had a really good fastball, stands 6'7", but really popped in the draft league. Control was off, but the Cardinals saw something there and gave him a six-digit bonus to sign as part of their international draft class, and now he's in their top 30. So there are some names that like might not look familiar yet, but like circle back in the draft league, the Appy League, a lot of these leagues that are meant to be.
I got lucky to catch a little bit of the Crosscutters game from yesterday, and it was fascinating because they knocked McDaniel out real early, Bloom right out. I think it was 6 runs in the second, and then it was a pitching duel on both sides the rest of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a real opportunity for these guys to take advantage of. I mean, growing up for me, especially as a Massachusetts kid, but just in general following baseball, it was always the Cape and little else. Like, other leagues existed for sure, but so much attention was on the Cape. Now you have these two MLB partner leagues that are designed to get guys noticed. And it's been really fun to see them blossom, and it's going to continue. Both are extended, I think, through 2030 now. So this is just the start.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Sam, I want to thank you for your time today. I think if someone listens from the start to the end, they're going to get a whole lot of really good information about a lot of things within prospects and prospecting. So thank you for your time. I want to remind everyone, once again, check out our socials. Chad, would you like to give me your Twitter? And we'll have everyone go through and give their Twitter address here real quick, just so folks can find you.
You can find me at CAO Chad TTV.
Okay. And Sam is...
Yeah, I am at Sam Dykstra, MILB, yep, on Twitter. And then you can follow all of our stuff at MLB Pipeline on Twitter, or MLB.com/pipeline, or MILB.com for minor league specific news.
And I am Big Gentle Ben on all the various socials. And if you want to get into this discussion, we have discussion like this a lot on our Discord every day, Palazzo Podcast Discord. Check it out. It's free to join, free to participate. But Sam, again, thank you. And folks, you've got yourself a heck of a podcast here to listen to lots of information on college baseball and the draft, on all sorts of things, prospects. So take some time, get yourself a cup of Joe, and enjoy it. We'll talk with you all.
And if you want to see Charlie Condren home run, just go to Sam's Twitter. I'm sure another one of them.
Oh, there's probably more coming. So.
Yeah.
So, all right. Thank you all for coming, and we will see you again soon.
The power of prospects is a curious thing. Make a person trade everything for a king. Wyatt Langford is your one true love. For a prospect, you'll trade all the above. It's cruel sometimes, but it might just save your life. That's the power of prospects. That's the power of